in this sutta that we're exploring, which, as somebody asked the question, what is the sutta we're exploring? It is in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 140. And it's called the Exposition of the Elements, the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. So in the sutta, as the Buddha comes to this place where he's pointing to the foundations of wisdom and of relinquishment and peace, he seems to be describing the mind of someone who is free. The phrase is, one possessing this supreme foundation of wisdom one possessing this supreme foundation of truth and one possessing this supreme foundation of relinquishment and in particular in the area of relinquishment. And it does seem that these foundations follow in a way on each other, that when one has understood with wisdom, experience is not me, not mine, not who I am, understood the impermanence, understood the conditioned nature of experience, freedom is available. The sutta says, one possessing this wisdom possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. This is the supreme noble wisdom, namely the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. This deliverance being founded on truth is unshakable. For that is false, which has a deceptive nature, and that is true, which has an undeceptive nature. Nibbana. Therefore, one possessing this truth possesses a supreme foundation of truth. And so it seems very natural that the wisdom, the opening to the foundation or the depth of wisdom leads one to this foundation of truth. And likewise, moving on to the foundation of relinquishment. It describes, formerly, when one was ignorant, one undertook and accepted acquisitions. And so again, it's pointing to the mind of someone who is no longer accepting and undertaking acquisitions. So again, this description is pointing to the mind of someone who is free. Formerly, when one was ignorant, one undertook and accepted acquisitions. Now has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, one possesses this relinquishment, possesses the supreme foundation of relinquishment. For this is the supreme noble relinquishment, the relinquishing of all acquisitions. So again, this relinquishment, what's described as this mind of having let go of acquisitions, seems to, at least in my read and understanding of the way this text unfolds, to be the natural outcome of the depth of the wisdom, the depth of understanding the truth, the depth of letting go of clinging, the depth of letting go of suffering. So this language here has abandoned acquisitions, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them so they are no longer subject to future arising. So, made them like a palm stump. I'm going to describe what that means because it's perhaps not an analogy that's very evocative for us. So the banana tree, basically the palm tree, has this this nature that after it blooms and produces bananas, when you cut it down, it doesn't grow anymore. It's not subject to future. It doesn't come back from the roots once it has bloomed. It's gone. It's done. And so that's this analogy of the palm stump. When you cut down the palm stump after it has bloomed, it will not come back from those roots. But these images, abandoning, cut it off at the root, it creates an image of activity, which kind of feels a little bit in contrast to me to the very natural unfolding that seems to come from the opening to the wisdom of not me, not mine, not who I am, opening to the wisdom of the impermanence of experience. How those, as Gil described last night, that those understandings create the conditions that the mind just doesn't want to cling anymore. And so the wisdom creates essentially the conditions for non-clinging. And yet here, this kind of activity abandoned them, cut them off at the root. So I'm interested in this juxtaposition of the very natural unfolding and the activity of relinquishment. Because it does say here, those activities associated with each of the foundations, one should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment and train for peace. And so what does it mean to cultivate relinquishment? What does it mean to abandon acquisitions? This word abandon has a little lesson for us in a way, even just reflecting on what the word means in English. Sometimes we have a kind of a negative connotation with that word, and that, you know, we talk about somebody abandoning their child, you know, abandoning something that needs caring for. That's not the definition of what we're exploring here with abandoning the acquisitions. There's some other meanings of the term that are more resonant with what we're doing. One of them being that there's a natural kind of abandonment of something when we understand it's not valuable anymore. It's not useful anymore. Or there's a natural abandoning when we recognize that there's some place of danger. So, you know, the phrase abandon ship, you know, that phrase, this place is dangerous, we don't stay here. That's another use of the word abandon. So this to me points to the recognition that these acquisitions, which I'll describe in a moment, it goes on to describe what these acquisitions are, or one perspective of what these acquisitions are. Abandoning these acquisitions comes from the understanding, the wisdom, that they're no longer of value and that they are essentially not a place of safety in our lives. You know, we've kind of mistaken something as safe that is very unsafe. And so these acquisitions, it's kind of interesting, the next paragraph. So he says, when one is ignorant, one undertook and accepted acquisitions, now has abandoned them. When one was ignorant, one experienced covetousness, desire, and lust, now has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm stump, done away with them. In ignorance, one experienced anger, ill will, and hate, and now has done away with them. In ignorance, one experienced ignorance and delusion, now has abandoned them. And so basically these three acquisitions, the acquisition of greed, the acquisition of aversion, the acquisition of delusion. Funny to think of those as acquisitions, isn't it? But they are acquired by us through the way we engage with the world, the way the world engages with us, a kind of a back and forth impact we have on the world and the world has on us. There's a famous quote by the Sutta, by the Buddha, something along the lines of, whatever one frequently ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. And what is it that we frequently ponder? We frequently ponder what's in our culture. We frequently ponder what is around us. We frequently engage in those activities of mind that we see reflected in the people around us. And so we acquire the views of greed, the view that our culture offers us, that the view of consumerism, having things will make me happy. We acquire the view that having pleasant experience is better than having unpleasant experience. Getting rid of unpleasant experience will make me happy. We acquire all kinds of perspectives, and we reinforce these patterns in our mind of greed, aversion, and delusion, cementing them, essentially acquiring them. And so they are acquired, and they can be released. To me, this is also a kind of a good news place in the teachings, that they are acquisitions. They are not fundamental parts of who we are. They're not hardwired into us, these patterns of greed, aversion, and delusion. They are pretty strongly patterned, pretty strongly conditioned into us, but they are not hardwired. They are acquired, and it is possible to release them. And the relinquishment is said to be peace. This is peace. The ending of greed, the ending of aversion, the ending of delusion. The ending of all acquisitions, this is peace. The ending of clinging, as Gil said last night. I thought to find the actual reference that he referred to, but this is the supreme peace, the ending of clinging. And so, again, it sounds like it's a very natural outcome of the wisdom, and yet it says there's this activity of abandoning. And so what does it mean? How do we cultivate relinquishment? This activity that one should cultivate relinquishment. Usually we're in the realm of not relinquishing. You know, this is We have been quite conditioned. We have put our minds have been in this soup, this stew of frequently being exposed to and naturally taking up what we're in the terrain of, which is a lot of greed, aversion, and delusion in our environment, in our cultures. Unfortunately, there are some explorations of clinging and letting go. You know, there's a teaching on different ways that we cling in the suttas, highlighting for us that if we can recognize clinging in these areas, it supports the letting go. Sometimes the clinging happens because we're not really cognizant that we're clinging. And so the teachings point to us, these are areas to look at. These are areas you're probably clinging. So check it out. One of these areas that we frequently cling to is sense pleasure. Of course we cling to sense pleasure. That's very natural. Things, when they're pleasurable and we have that pleasure, some part of us wants to hold on to it. It feels good. It's nice to have that. When we manage to get rid of something that's unpleasant, there's a pleasure to that, a sense of, oh, phew, I've figured that one out. That's no longer bothering me. This is a pretty deeply rooted pattern. You know, animals do this kind of clinging. Babies do this kind of clinging. And yet, again, as I said, it's not hardwired. It is, it's kind of like what seems to happen is that as we go through our lives, you know, we get something that we like and it's like, oh, that feels good. And so there's a moment in that getting what we like of happiness, a moment of releasing of tension, a moment of, ha, ah, that feels good. And because that's a very common way of getting a sense of well-being, some sort of well-being, we go for another one of those. You know, there's kind of a sense that if I can just string along enough of these moments of pleasure and getting rid of the unpleasant, that will be what happiness is. You know, it's not the pleasurable experience itself that's an issue here, because pleasure will come. You know, it's not that we somehow have to live in a world and, oh, better not feel any pleasure. What we need to be on the lookout for is that latching onto, holding onto, wanting to keep it, wanting to control it. And so in some ways we need to let go of our usual relationship to sense pleasure. Let go of our need to construct our lives around this operating principle. And that's challenging because until we actually meet another path, perhaps, another way of exploring our world, another way of discovering perhaps a different kind of happiness or a deeper kind of happiness, having what we want is about as good as it gets. You know, it's like this is the best thing going, you know. And we don't see, we don't understand a way in which we can have happiness if we're not oriented towards having the sense pleasure. And so the teachings, as we explore our practice, as we explore our minds, as we listen to the teachings, we begin to understand actually that this kind of pleasure that comes from the sense realm is actually one of the least forms of happiness that's available to us. The Buddha actually says, yes, there is a form of happiness in getting what you want, but there are many other forms of happiness out there. One of the forms of happiness, I think I talked about this the other day, watching what happens if you let go of wanting. There's a happiness that comes from the release of the wanting. That's kind of a deeper form of happiness than having the moment of getting what we want. So exploring, what does it mean to explore letting go of our usual relationship to sense pleasure? It's not easy, because we are so, it's at the end of the Buddha, sometimes talks about his training as being swimming upstream, going against the stream of everything that most of our culture points us in the direction of. So he suggests, you know, I love this teaching. He suggests, really, with respect to sense pleasure, start where you are. Recognize, okay, there is a kind of a happiness that comes from getting what you want. Understand that. Understand the gratification that comes with getting what you want. What is it? What is that gratification that comes from getting what you want? Some of it you'll see is that there is a moment of happiness that comes from just the having. That's a piece of it. But the other piece of it is what I talked about the other day. There's a kind of a, in the moment of the having, part of the happiness of that having is that the discomfort of the wanting has ended. So in the moment of getting what we want, we get a double hit of ease or happiness there. We get the, oh, I've got that thing, and we have the pleasure of that itself. Or if in the getting rid of, you know, we have the pleasure of the fact that we're no longer associating with something that's unpleasant. And the other piece of the happiness there is that the discomfort of wanting, that off feeling of I need, I want, this is not the way I want it to be. The discomfort of that has released. For a moment, it has released. And as we see that, as we watch this in our experience, we see what is the gratification that comes from getting what I want. We see that the releasing of the wanting is a part of it. And actually, as we perhaps do the exploration I suggested the other day of just watching the wanting and not following through on it, you may see that the happiness that comes from the letting go of the wanting is really the greater part of the happiness that comes from getting what we want. Now, wanting is not going to tell you. Now, wanting has its delusions. It has its stories. Sayadaw Utejaniya says it has its job. And the job of wanting is to get what it wants. And its job is to convince you that it's necessary to get what it wants in order for you to be happy. And so, you know, greed, wanting, is not going to tell you, oh, by the way, if I go away, you'll be happy. That's not greed's job description. And so we have to kind of take a leap of faith to check it out for ourselves. And so understanding what is the gratification of having something that we want, understand that. This is looking at experience, turning with mindfulness towards what we're experiencing. When he explores that gratification, the next piece he says is, okay, so you've seen the gratification. Now pay attention to how long it actually lasts. When you get something, a pleasure, a sense pleasure that you like, how long does the happiness of that actually last? It doesn't last very long. Sometimes we don't notice that, because as soon as that moment has come and gone, we're already on to the next moment of, oh, what's the next thing that I can want so that I can get the next moment of that? And so we see that the danger, actually, of being on that cycle of getting what we want is that, well, we get a little bit of happiness, but what it does is it just perpetuates this cycle of, Oh, get a moment of sense pleasure. Oh, it goes away. Oh, what's the next thing I want to do? Well, the last time I was really happy was when I had something I want. So what can I want to want? This, what I now call Google mind. What do I want to search for? You know, I sometimes find myself sitting in front of the computer. Ooh, what do I want to know? When I find myself in that state and mindfulness arises, like, okay, shut the computer down. Just don't encourage that mind state. So this is an exploration for us. You know, again, this brings back the wisdom piece. We explore, what's our relationship to sense pleasure? Can we be curious about what the gratification we get from that is? How long it lasts? Seeing the pattern that's perpetuated around it. Again, not with any idea that sense pleasure itself is bad, but that the holding around it creates suffering. How, you know, what is the suffering in the realm of holding to sense pleasure? I mean, part of it is just the endless cycle of effort to keep constructing the world so that it's okay. Sometimes it feels like our whole sense of well-being is dependent on this engine of getting what I want. And so there's this huge amount of effort that goes into trying to construct our world so that it's stringing along these little moments of sense pleasure, getting rid of unpleasant, having pleasant, getting rid of unpleasant, having pleasant. How much work that takes to construct our world. And then if we do have something, if we're holding to it, you know, if we're, you know, clinging to it very tightly, thinking it's mine, when impermanence rears its head and essentially proves to us, well, it's not really yours, and we suffer. We suffer. And there's a difference between, I mean, there is an experience, I think, of loss and of heartbreak that happens, especially with relationship and loss of loved ones. And yet there's a kind of a very natural heartbreak that happens around loss. But there's also often a sense of, it shouldn't be this way, it was wrong, what did I do wrong that loss happened, or it shouldn't be like this, as opposed to recognizing, yes, it is like this. This is the truth. Impermanence is the truth. There's a way, to me, times when I felt sadness is so pure, you know, not sticky. Sometimes when there's sadness, it feels like it's like grabbing inside of our heart. It's like, no, no, no. And sometimes it just flows through and it's like, yes, this is the truth. This is the way loss is. And it doesn't have the quality of suffering in the same way. It actually evokes a sense of compassion rather than bitterness or anger or hatred or confusion. So letting go of clinging to sense pleasure, exploring how we do cling to sense pleasure. This is a big part of the practice, I think, with all of these clingings, is that, you know, we often will find ourselves clinging to something and we don't know how to let go. And so the practice in that moment is, this is what it's like to be clinging. This is the experience of holding on. And we see in that moment how painful it is. The grip of the holding on itself is already suffering. This is a lot of our practice. We might have this idea of, oh, you know, relinquish sense pleasure. I should be able to do that. I should just be able to say, okay, this is what they've said is a good idea, so I should be able to flip the switch and not cling to it anymore. It doesn't work that way. We have to over and over see how we do cling, experience, recognize the suffering of that clinging, see the times when the heart lets go of that clinging, and understand the relationship between the suffering and the clinging. That's where the wisdom grows, in contact with that suffering. We also cling to views, a second form of that are identified in the text as things that we cling to. We cling to ideas about how things should be, views about ourselves, about the world, about others. We have personal views about who we are. I am the kind of person who always can analyze things or figure things out, or I'm the kind of person who is always kind or friendly, or I'm not the kind of person who something or other. And so we have these views about ourselves, and we kind of box ourselves in some ways, taking ourselves to be that. They're cultural views, views we have about what society is, how it should be, views that we've brought in to ourselves based on the conditioning from the world, that back and forth between the world and us. Cultural views from our families, from our societies. These are often so obscured because often we've grown up in the terrain of everybody around us having a similar view, and so it's like the water we're swimming in. We're not really aware that it's a view. It's just the way things are. And then perhaps we meet somebody from a different perspective, or I started doing travel to other countries when I was in my late 20s and really began to have some of my views, my cultural views, you know, exposed. You know, what I think is right is not, you know, something as simple as how close you stand to somebody, or whether two women who are friends holding hands walk down the street together, whether that's normal or usual, what it means. You know, does it mean your friends? Does it mean your partners? You know, what does it mean? So many different assumptions we have based on the familiarity of what we've grown up in. So these views, personal views, views of who we are, who others are, views of culture, society, how people should behave, these kind of become like filters. They're just the way we see the world, the way we take in information comes through these views. And often the views are in the subterranean level. We're not so conscious of them. And so this is why they're so powerful, or our views are so powerful. They are clung to, and we're not even aware they're there sometimes. We're not even aware of them. So we first need to let go. And to let go of views, we need to first recognize that we have them. We need to explore, look at whether there are sometimes value judgments can betray beliefs. You know, whether we think of something as right or wrong, or normal or not normal. You know, that what I said a moment before around, you know, does someone consider it normal when two people walk down the street together, two people of the same gender walk down the street together holding hands? You know, that, you know, betrays in a way some of my own upbringing when I said that. when I said, is that normal or not? You know, in my upbringing, that was frowned upon. I got to the Peace Corps in Vanuatu, and it was a completely, you know, everybody did that. Everybody held hands. If you were friends with somebody, you held hands with them. So that, you know, whether when we have these perspectives or value judgments, you know, do we think of something normal or not? Is it right or wrong? Is it good or bad? Is it beautiful or ugly, better or worse? Those kinds of words in our minds might betray some beliefs, some views kind of underground, under the surface. Views are so powerful. There's so much of the engine of belief underneath our experience drives our suffering. For myself, a belief around I'm no good, or, you know, I'm a failure, or something along those lines. And these views that I'm talking about now, I'm kind of interweaving two of the kinds of clinging that are talked about. There's one, just views, clinging to views about people, or views about what's right or wrong, or normal or not normal, just views along those lines. And then there are views about ourselves, identity views. They're both highlighted in this kind of clinging. And so sometimes the beliefs in some kind of a sense of I or me or mine, a sense of identity of I am a kind of person who usually is successful. And when that belief kind of gets proven that I'm not always the kind of person that's successful, my mind would go crashing to the other side. Well, obviously I'm a failure. Obviously I'm no good. Obviously, I can't do things. And so seeing, you know, these beliefs at work, they're so sometimes underground, these beliefs, that we don't even know they're there. I was in my mid-40s before I understood that I had a pattern of self-hatred, an identity of self-hatred that was deeply motivating my actions. It was so hidden under my sense of competence and I can do things well, that it wasn't until I really started looking at my mind that I saw this underground belief in, oh, this means I'm a failure. Oh, how do I work really hard so that I don't feel that? And so they can be so hidden from us. As we begin to see these beliefs, as we begin to recognize, oh, you know, what kind of beliefs do we have? What's normal? What's not normal? Who am I? What are the beliefs I have about myself? What are beliefs I have about people? As we begin to uncover those, they have less of a power to inform or influence our speech and our actions, or influence how we are or who we are. And yet, when we start to see those beliefs, sometimes, you know, it's like, when I started to see that belief, you're a failure, you're no good, I was like, how do I get rid of that? You know, that's not a good thing to be thinking. Clearly, this is a bad thought. I should not have that thought. And yet it was so powerful, so deeply ingrained, that what I recognized slowly over a long stretch of time of practice was that I had to recognize this is the belief that's happening. To just simply, oh, that belief is happening right now. Sometimes what's helpful, I mean, we sometimes will, as we see a belief arise, like you're a failure, or you know, you can't do things right. You know, there's kind of, in a way, it feels like an emotional reality to that. It's like that's the emotional truth in that moment. And yet our rational mind tries to come in and tell us, oh, it's not true. You know, you're really okay. You know, so sometimes that's how we try to go at things when we see these beliefs. You know, we try to come at it from the perspective of, that was an old belief. I don't need that belief anymore. And yet the emotional reality is, yes, there's the feeling of I'm a failure or whatever your belief is, you know. So what I found over time was that what I needed to do was to have the courage to say, this is the belief that's arising right now. This belief is being believed. Actually, that ends up being really powerful. This acknowledgement, this is a belief. When it's acknowledged as belief, there's a little part of the mind that begins to understand, all right, this is what feels like an emotional truth, and it's what's happening right now, but it's not truth with a capital T. It's a belief. This is a belief that's happening right now. So what that does of acknowledging beliefs, of acknowledging views, is it brings the mind into alignment with what's happening, which is a belief is arising in this moment. And so the mind is not fighting with itself, trying to convince itself, don't believe that. It's just, yes, this belief, it's already happening, actually. It's already here. It's already come up. There it is. So believing is happening right now. And it can sometimes create a little bit of space, a little bit of, okay, that's happening right now. And kind of the little space to recognize it's just a belief. It is a belief. It's being believed. Sometimes the worst kind of clinging happens, and people have sometimes said that, this, you know, it's like, yes, but this is a true belief. What do I do with that? You still have to acknowledge it is a belief. Maybe there is, social injustice. You know, we see in the world so much injustice, and we recognize, yeah, that's wrong. It's a belief that it's wrong, but it's true, you know. And so there can be so much tightness around that, you know, when it's a belief and there's a kind of a sense of, yeah, this is a right belief, you know. What I'd like to suggest is that when there is a kind of a clinging around what we think of as a true belief or a right belief, that holding and that clinging actually gets in the way of, well, I mean, like what's happening right now is like, there is this injustice that's happening in the world. There is a social injustice happening. Having the view that it shouldn't be happening in this moment is, well, it is happening. And so as we, you know, recognize, okay, it is happening, can I come into alignment with the fact that it is happening and opening to that reality that it's happening? And yet with that meeting of that and seeing the suffering that comes with that reality, the heart moves towards a compassionate action that doesn't have to be held tight around, and this is true. This is a true belief. It's a delicate line. It's a very delicate dance. But I would just propose to you that the clinging around something like social injustice actually keeps us from engaging in a skillful and compassionate way, because there's still some holding in the heart. And so again, as I said the other day, you know, wisdom acts, compassion acts. The more we can open to compassion and wisdom, the more a transformative process can happen, even in relationships with the world. And so around views, coming back to clinging to views, as we reckon, the first most important thing is to recognize they're there. And again, as with the sense pleasure, it's going to be hard. Often we can't simply say, oh, there's a view, I'm clinging to it, that's no good, let's stop the clinging. Sometimes all we can do is recognize there's a belief and I'm caught by it. There's a belief and I'm clinging to it. There's a view there. And I actually find belief is a word that's actually more resonant to me than view. And that's the word I use in my own practice these days. You know, when I notice suffering is happening, you know, when suffering's happening, there's some kind of a view there being held to. And I'm reminding myself of that these days. When I see suffering, like, oh, there's that suffering, there's some kind of agitation in the mind. There's a view there. I may not even know what that belief is. There's some kind of belief happening. I just remind myself, right, this agitation's happening because some kind of belief is happening. And something about that reminder, you know, that's bringing wisdom in. It's bringing in consciously a perspective that supports the mind. Bringing that perspective in, at least for me, it's like, oh, right, so the belief engine is at work. Okay, the belief engine is at work. This agitation is a manifestation. It's happening because that belief engine is at work. And when I remind myself of that, it's not that the agitation necessarily vanishes, but there's some way in which the mind can go, right, this is what's happening. This is because this belief engine is working. This agitation is happening. And it creates the conditions for being able to meet that suffering with less resistance. And this is so much of the work around clinging, around letting go of clinging, that we find ways to meet our experience without resistance so that we can see the clinging. I'm going to skip over the fourth kind of clinging. I'll just briefly mention it. It's clinging to rules and observances. Kind of, you know, in the time of the Buddha, there were often certain behaviors that were understood. Oh, if you do this, you'll be free. And so people would bathe in the river Ganges and think that that itself was a purifying thing. Or there was one practice of behaving like a naked dog. He would, you know, run around on all fours barking and only eating food that people threw to you. It was believed to be a purification process. So there were these kind of ritualistic ways of behaving that people clung to thinking it would lead to freedom. And the Buddha pointed to just simply clinging to rules that or practices, simply acting practices, is not the way to freedom. You know, we can think of this in our own culture as like, what are the rules of our culture? You know, I mentioned this earlier, you know, one of the main kind of rituals of our Western culture, of our American Western culture, is consumerism. And that will make us happy. That's where freedom is. I get enough money, that will make me happy. And that's a kind of a belief system at work that, you know, if you just follow that, you'll see. Actually, from what I understand, if people... I was just listening to an interview of somebody who had a recent shift from not having a lot of money, then writing a book and suddenly being in great demand as a speaker and having a lot of money. And it's like, yeah, the money doesn't make me happy. So, you know, this is another form of clinging that Buddha warns us against, this kind of clinging just to things. You know, we can cling just like you might think of, if I sit still with my eyes closed and my legs crossed, maybe that will bring freedom. Not if you don't turn towards experience and explore with the practice. The simple form is not sufficient for freedom. So, clinging. We do this clinging. We are very practiced at clinging. We've done it for a long time. And it's quite conditioned. You know, as I said, you know, there's times in our practice, you know, sometimes in our practice we can start to see certain kinds of clinging, certain holdings of like, and recognize, oh, that's not useful. And very naturally and easily maybe have that abandoning, you know, in the recognizing, oh, that's not valuable. There can sometimes, I would say, not very often, at least in my own practice, that when I recognize a clinging, there can be a, oh yeah, that's not so helpful, let me let go of that. That can happen occasionally. More often, there's this sense, yeah, I'm seeing this clinging, I'd let go if I knew how. I have no idea how to let go of this clinging. Feeling the tightness, the constriction, the suffering of the clinging. The practice at that moment is to basically notice the suffering of clinging. That clinging and suffering are, they come together. And it's also a little bit of a lesson for us that clinging is not self. To paraphrase one text of the Buddha, radically paraphrased, clinging is not self. If clinging were self, it would be possible to be say of clinging, clinging, go away. But clinging is not self, so it is not always possible to say of clinging, clinging, be gone. It is a deeply conditioned pattern, and so a lot of our work and practice is to recognize that we aren't able to relinquish. This is not a mistake. It doesn't mean that you're doing the practice wrong. It doesn't mean that your practice has failed you. It's a huge part of how the learning of mindfulness works. We turn with wise attention, with friendly attention even, kind attention to that clinging and the suffering of that clinging. And the system, the organism, begins to deeply, deeply understand clinging is suffering. Before we turn to it with mindfulness, we don't understand this. We don't understand clinging is suffering. We think clinging is the way to happiness. We think clinging to pleasant things is the way to happiness. We think holding to identities and feeling like I'm the successful one, that is happiness. We are so confused that we think clinging is happiness. And so this turning towards with mindfulness, what clinging actually is, basically gives the mind an education. It gives it helpful information about what clinging is and how it creates suffering. Our organism, we're really fortunate, actually, in the way our organism is put together, I think. It seems to me that our organism kind of, there's one neurobiologist I read said, our organism is oriented towards a kind of a homeostasis, a kind of a well-being of organism. That's where it's trying to head. It's trying to head to well-being. And there's such a capacity for delusion in our minds that, and the way that we've been trained, the whole, you know, culture, the acquisitions we've absorbed in our culture. There's so much of that that we, our minds believe, again, they believe that clinging is happiness. And so from that perspective, that delusive perspective, the best that it gets is having these moments of clinging, having these moments of sense pleasure. And so as we turn with mindfulness to clinging is suffering, instead of clinging will make me happy, the organism reorients and understands, oh, this is not the way to happiness. And begins to, the kind of the wisdom that begins to arise that we've been talking about, that begins to shift our perspective on the world. Wisdom begins to help the organism understand how to let go. As our system gets good information about clinging and suffering, the wisdom begins to naturally arise to shift us towards non-suffering. To me, this is how this whole practice, one way this whole practice works. Wise attention creates the conditions for the bubble of delusion about clinging to be burst and begin to orient us towards letting go. Begins to orient us towards the deepest kind of well-being. The relinquishment of acquisitions is peace. I'll read this last bit from the sutta. One possessing this peace possesses the supreme foundation of peace, for this is the supreme noble peace, namely the pacification of lust, hatred, and delusion, the relinquishing of the acquisition of lust, hatred, and delusion. Release, perhaps another word for relinquishment. Release is peace. It takes courage to meet our clinging, to meet our views, a sense of, are we willing to stand in the middle of our lives and witness them? That very witnessing creates the conditions for wisdom, truth, release, and peace.